Today is Monday, March 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, grieving mourners in New Zealand wait for the return of the bodies of their loved ones. New information on the crash of an Ethiopian jetliner, how climate change will change tourism in seaside communities. Also ahead, the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's all on today's International Edition. Families of the 50 people killed in the Christchurch mosque shootings are enduring an increasingly agonizing wait for the bodies of victims to be released as New Zealand reels from the unprecedented tragedy. 3 days after Friday's attacks, New Zealand's deadliest shooting in modern history, relatives were anxiously waiting for word on when they can bury their loved ones. Islamic tradition calls for bodies to be cleansed and buried as soon as possible after death, usually within 24 hours. Authorities hope to release all the bodies by Wednesday. In the first of a two-part interview, I spoke with Jacinta Carroll, a senior research fellow at the Australian National University's National Security College.
One of the extraordinary things I think we've seen with this response is that Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has really come out in a very dignified and very strong leadership role. Her message has been about inclusiveness. She talks about community and this being an attack on New Zealand. And the focus that she has put, the grievous attack that this is on New Zealand's values, and focusing on trying to bring that community back together and to heal the community, not focusing really on the perpetrator so much. This has been very, very well received in New Zealand and globally. It's been very, very warmly received by the Muslim community in New Zealand and in Australia. Not just her words, but also her action. And I have to say, as someone who works in counter-terrorism and countering violent extremism, we talk often about the importance of getting the counter-narrative right, to get the statements of values right. And for a leader who has never had to deal with this before and a country that's never had to deal with this before, it's textbook perfect. But it appears to not be contrived. This is from the heart, and it's sending a very powerful message to counter terrorism and to counter what appears to be the desired effect of the attacker.
Talk a little bit about the rarity of gun violence in New Zealand.
By comparison to Australia, it has liberal gun laws, but this comes from the makeup of New Zealand. It's a highly rural and agricultural country. There is a strong culture of hunting feral animals, and also of sporting shooting, target rifle, air rifle, and New Zealand, like Australia, does very well in those sports. What this means is that for a country of just 5 million people, I understand they have around 1.5 million firearms lawfully owned within the community. So there's a very high level of gun ownership, very low level of gun-related violence. And we've seen in Australia, as in New Zealand, most gun violence tends to be perpetrated by organised crime with illegally obtained weapons. And the terrible incidents that had been seen in New Zealand previously, where you'd had more than one casualty from a gun-related attack, had tended to be in families. So this type of incident is extraordinarily unusual. So it's quite shocking. There are a lot of calls at the moment to review and revise New Zealand's gun laws. The Prime Minister has said that she will be doing this as a matter of urgency. I would expect that Australia and New Zealand will be working very closely together, because Australia has a national firearms agreement between all our states and territories that provides very good regulation of legitimate access to and use of firearms, with a whole range of limitations on the type of firearm you can access.
The relationship between the two countries, it's a pretty strong one.
New Zealand and Australia see themselves really as one country. We have 500,000 Kiwis call Australia home as a residence. That's a very big proportion of their population. Hundreds of thousands more Australians have New Zealand backgrounds or relatives. Auckland in New Zealand is closer to Sydney than Perth is. This is a place that we all know and love. There's a lot of movement between the two at a personal level, a cultural level. Even our sporting codes, our provincial competitions usually have New Zealand teams. The focus right now is on what are the governments doing together. On counter-terrorism, Australia and New Zealand actually, again, have been dealing for a number of years with this issue at an interagency level, almost as one country. There's an Australia and New Zealand counterterrorism committee that report to both governments. They will be using all of these mechanisms and these connections to jointly investigate what's happening and also to get a very good handle on the threat. And in another way, Australian government authorities are providing a range of services, victim identification services, which sadly Australia also assisted with at the Christchurch earthquake a couple of years ago. And importantly for investigating this threat, Australia has, in the Australian Federal Police, a technical data capability that will be looking at the improvised explosive devices to try and find out what does that tell us about this person and where he might have got his technical skills. So essentially, we've got a personal level, Australia is in shock, and all Australians are reeling from this incident. But there is a lot of effort, the full weight of the capabilities in Australia are being used to assist New Zealand in investigating what else might be going on in terms of a right-wing terrorist threat, and also helping the country to recover.
Well, the suspect in the shootings is 28-year-old white supremacist Brenton Harrison Tarrant. He appeared in court the day after the shootings amid strict security, shackled and wearing all-white prison garb. He showed no emotion when the judge read one murder charge and said more charges would likely follow. The New Zealand Herald reported Monday that he had dismissed his appointed lawyer and plans to defend himself. Tarrant had posted a muddled 74-page anti-immigrant manifesto online before the attacks and apparently used a helmet mounted on a camera to broadcast live video of the slaughter. Facebook said it removed 1.5 million videos of the shootings during the first 24 hours after the massacre. The revelation in a tweet provided a chilling snapshot of how quickly provocative and often disturbing images circulate on the internet. Marie Fitzgerald is the grandmother of Tarrant. She tells Australia's Channel 9 that she noticed a change in her grandson's behaviour.
It's only since he travelled overseas, I think, that that boy has changed completely to the boy we knew.
Tarrant is an Australian national who'd been living in New Zealand for a few years. Meanwhile, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has been comforting mourners at a mosque in Wellington, hugging them and weeping with family members of the victims. Ardern is being praised for how she's handling the crisis. In part two of my conversation with Jacinta Carroll, senior fellow at the Australian National University's National Security College, she talks more about that. You talk a lot about the rise in right-wing extremism. A lot of people are calling it white nationalism, which appears to be growing throughout the world. The U.S. president commented on that, saying that he didn't think that it was. Are people there talking at all about the contrast in how the U.S. president has reacted?
The president of the United States is a very significant global leader, so what he says does get headline reporting around the world, and certainly in the New Zealand media, his response has been a headline issue. And I think there's a bit of puzzlement in New Zealand and Australia because it appears to be generally across the board, regardless of what political party you are, whichever community you are, this is seen to be an extreme manifestation of some of the concerning trends we've seen just in populist rhetoric alone, let alone the more sinister manifestations of it in right-wing nationalism, white supremacy, and so on. So there is a bit of puzzlement that this is the approach that's been taken from the United States because it's not, well, the President of the United States, because that it seemed to be fairly well understood here that there is a link and there is a problem. Helpfully, in Australia and New Zealand, it's leading to a very healthy discussion about how we talk about each other and how we describe community politics, how we talk about the complex issues in the world, and to try to avoid vilifying different members of the community as we try to come up with complex and nuanced responses to those issues. In Australia and in New Zealand, this was very quickly called a terrorist attack, and as someone who works on terrorism, that's absolutely correct in terms of law as well as motivation, which is an important part of the law. So again, there's been some reporting in the press in New Zealand and Australia with some puzzlement that this appeared to have been called by one of the White House advisors an eco-terrorist attack. That's not a term that really lands here at all. It's seen as right-wing terrorism or domestic terrorism. The association with the Muslim community is one that has really had a very positive impact in drawing community together. Around Australia, it was extraordinary to see the numbers of people who turned out to mosques on Sunday over our weekend. In one state, in Victoria, it was a mosque open day that day, and they were very worried about any possible threat and also concerned that people might turn up, might not turn up. But of course, Australians turned up in record numbers to support the Muslim community. The way that this issue has affected the community and even some artificial debate about Muslims versus the West has had exactly the opposite impact in our countries. It really has drawn New Zealanders and Australians of all types closer together. And even some of our right-wing shock jocks from the media are pushing this message very strongly.
All right. That's Senior Fellow, Research Fellow at the Australian National University's National Security College, Jacinta Carroll. Thank you for being with us. Meanwhile, thousands of people struggling to make sense of the tragedy have been paying tribute to the victims at makeshift memorials in Christchurch, the leafy city of 400,000 people known for its English heritage and the river that meanders through it. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump again attacks John McCain months after his death for his role in the Russia probe. Disabled victims are the Syrian war's most vulnerable. Russia's president plans to mark 5 years of annexation in Crimea. And an exhibit traces post-colonial migration to London and Paris through music. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Ethiopian officials say the black box from the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 is in good condition. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Thousands of mourners gathered in the streets of Ethiopia's capital Sunday, accompanying 17 empty caskets draped in the national flag. The service came a day after officials began delivering bags of earth to family members instead of the remains of the 157 victims, because the identification process is expected to take a long time. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's transport minister says data from Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302's black box shows a clear similarity with October's Lion Air crash off Indonesia. The U.S. and other countries have grounded Boeing 737 MAX 8s amid suspicions that faulty sensors and software contributed to the two crashes. I'm Ben Thomas.
Healthcare in America is again expected to be a deeply divisive issue in the 2020 U.S. presidential election, with Democrats pressing for more government involvement and Republicans warning of increased taxes and what they see as creeping socialism. But as VOA's Brian Padden reports, there are also competing proposals among Democratic candidates that advocate either transformational change to energize the progressive base or incremental progress to attract moderate support.
Growing public support for health care programs helped the Democratic Party win control of the U.S. House of Representatives in the 2018 election, and advocates believe it will also help the party nominee in 2020.
Health care is a winning issue for Democrats, so I think any way that they focus on health care and solutions is going to be beneficial to them.
Republicans have had to fend off criticism that conservative efforts to cut government funding would deny care to many in need.
No one's trying to deny the sick health care. I think that's an important thing to clarify. What's important is how we achieve that.
The rising cost of health care continues to be a major concern in the U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, who lost the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016, is again running on a promise to expand the government Medicare program for senior citizens to provide universal health care funded by increased taxes.
The goal of a rational health care system is not to make insurance companies billions in profits and CEO compensation for their executives off the wall.
Other prominent Democrats supporting this expansion are California Senator Kamala Harris and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. But there are concerns that proposing a government takeover of the $2.5 trillion health care industry could alienate centrist voters in the general election. More moderate Democratic hopefuls, such as Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and former Vice President Joe Biden, who is still considering whether to run, endorse incremental measures like a government public option plan to compete against private insurance companies. But such an approach may alienate the party's progressive base, calling for transformational change. President Donald Trump has criticized Democratic health care proposals as socialist.
Democrat lawmakers are now embracing socialism. They want to replace individual rights with total government domination.
During the 2016 campaign, Trump promised not to cut assistance programs, but in this year's budget, the president proposed reducing funding for both Medicare and Medicaid, which provides medical assistance to the poor and disabled. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
25 years have passed since Rwanda's horrific genocide, but for survivor Sylvester Sendakaye, the memories remain fresh. He was one of several survivors of genocide stretching back as far as the mass slaughter of Jews during World War II, on hand to commemorate the opening of a new permanent exhibition at the Holocaust and Genocide Center in Johannesburg. And while the events may seem long ago and far away from South Africa, curators say the lessons are more important today than ever. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
92-year-old Veronica Phillips was just a teenager when the Nazis sent her to a concentration camp. She and her family were among millions of Jews targeted in the Nazi-led Holocaust during World War II. The war ended when she was 19. She moved to South Africa in 1956 to be with her brother. For decades, she refused to speak of her experience, but it has haunted her for most of her life.
I had 8 miscarriages because they gave us bromides and it killed my reproduction organ. I couldn't have any children.
South Africa is far away from the horrors of these genocides, but the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center, which opens to the public this month, has long been needed, says its director, Tali Nates. South Africa has its own history of colonialism, apartheid, and violence. Nates says that exposing South Africans to these stories could help them tell their own difficult stories.
So we find that talking about other case studies, other crimes against humanity or genocide, or other atrocities, will allow us to speak about our own history.
The center also focuses on Rwanda's 1994 genocide. This year marks the 25th anniversary of those 100 horrific days that saw the slaughter of 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus. Sylvester Sendakaye was just 14 when he hid in a Kigali church and watched the murder of his parents and 3 siblings. He says he still suffers from regular nightmares, but he forces himself to tell his story to visitors to the center.
I find that the only way that we can fight this ideology of racism, ideology of violence, they can see what the human being came to do, how come we came to be an animal, not even animal behaves better. I think that's the only way people can avoid it happening, not only in Rwanda.
Nate says the center will feature temporary exhibitions on other genocidal acts, such as the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia in the 1990s, the war in Sudan's Darfur region, and more. These stories are complex and difficult. But Nate says it's often the tiny, personal items, like a doll, that best convey the toll these events took on ordinary people.
And this is the most treasured item for me in this exhibition. Childhood dreams, hopes, shattered by others, but keeping the memory alive, creating a life for herself. She was a geneticist. She was a lecturer at this university here next door. Yet she kept that doll and trusted me in this center to keep it for many generations to come.
That doll belonged to Phillips, who carried it and her tragic story close to her heart for 7 decades. Now she's telling the world and hoping she can change things for the better. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, in spite of decades of effort to fight homelessness in the United States, many people still sleep on the streets or in public shelters. As Tim Exton reports from Seattle, some homeless people are taking matters into their own hands, regaining control of one aspect of their lives at the same time.
Every Sunday, the residents of this homeless encampment, 10 miles south of Seattle, attend a compulsory meeting to discuss camp affairs and make decisions about its future.
This is 1073. It's a self-managed, democratically social, organized encampment that's run by the participants, for the participants. It's a clean and sober encampment. The kinds of people you get here are people who are recovering from various addictions or people who are just on extremely hard times.
One of a dozen such organized encampments in Seattle, Tent City 3's population varies from 50 to 100 people, children to seniors. The camp is self-policed and moves its location every 6 months. It offers its residents a structured alternative to sleeping on the streets, in night shelters, or in informal tent encampments where the threat of drugs, alcohol, and crime exist. It gives those such as Michael and Carissa Cleveland a chance to get back on their feet.
It helps a lot, really, because honestly, I'm not the most strong-willed, as she could tell you. If there was alcohol just freely flowing, I'd more than likely would lapse more than I have in the past.
It's security for me. It's a tremendous amount of security, and I feel like there's a whole lot of people around me that care.
Average rents in Seattle have risen more than 60% in the last 7 years, fueled, many believe, by a tech boom that has seen companies like Amazon bring tens of thousands of new workers to the city. Last year, an annual survey counted over 12,000 people as homeless in Seattle and surrounding King County, with more than half classified as unsheltered because they were living on the street, in tents, or in vehicles. Some remain unconvinced of the value of self-governing tent cities, especially those housing recovering addicts.
There are no social workers who come in there. There are no health workers who come in there. The camps are entirely voluntary, and people go to those camps with the understanding that they won't be expected to do anything to get themselves out of the camp.
Advocates for the homeless agree that tent cities are just a stopgap measure.
The big picture is clear. We need massive investments of local, state, and federal dollars in creating new, deeply affordable subsidized housing.
It's a sentiment echoed by one Tent City 3 resident.
Don't get me wrong, I like this camp. I like what it does. I like how it helps people. But I'm disappointed that it has to exist.
With little immediate prospect for construction of affordable housing on the scale required in Seattle, it seems that Tent City 3 and other camps like it will be needed to provide shelter for the homeless for some time to come. Tim Exton for Voice of America News, Seattle.
Well, as climate change heats up, we can expect more extreme weather events, more hurricanes and drought over time. But small flooding events will also become more common, and while not catastrophic, according to a new report, these events are already taking a toll on some local communities. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
When people think of climate change, they generally think of extreme weather, like droughts and hurricanes. Certainly, there will be more of those, and they will be more intense as the planet heats up. But a new study by Stanford researchers suggests that smaller flooding events like these are also having an increasing impact on coastal communities.
Water is rushing into roadways, coming up through the storm drain, and having different types of impacts and really short floods that don't leave all that much lasting damage.
The researchers wanted to see the impact small floods have on coastal communities. They chose the tourist destination of Annapolis, Maryland, that gets about 60 days a year of high tide flooding. A little bit of water, it turns out, can really dampen tourists' enthusiasm.
We found that 2% of visitors aren't coming because of flooding. So 3,000 fewer people are going to those businesses because of floods.
And as climate change heats up, that's only going to get worse, which means fewer tourist dollars. The good news is that these cities know what's coming.
These types of choices are really important because over the course of this century, many millions of Americans face the potential for inundation from sea level rise. And it's really a new frontier to figure out how we'll adapt and prepare.
Studies predict many Americans means between 4 to 13 million who will be threatened by sea level rise in the coming century. That's way more than the system can absorb. Kevin Enochs, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Have you ever wondered how much our home galaxy weighs? Well, according to recent measurements astronomers call the most accurate made so far, our Milky Way galaxy weighs about 1.5 trillion solar masses. That's the equivalent of 1.5 trillion suns. The astronomers gauged the mass of the Milky Way with the help of NASA's Hubble Space Telescope and the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. Writing their findings in a study to be published by Astrophysical Journal, the astronomers remarked that of the galaxy's total mass, only a few percent comes from what they estimate to be its 200 billion stars and the 4 billion solar mass giant black hole at the center of the Milky Way. The study suggests most of the remaining mass can be attributed to the mysterious and invisible substance known as dark matter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It's Women's History Month, and what a better way to honor women in our music segment than with the late, great Aretha Franklin. In January of 1987, she became the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She joined music legends like Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, and Muddy Waters. And now there are just over three dozen female performers or bands with women that have become a member of this exclusive club. In 2010, Rolling Stone magazine ranked Aretha Franklin as number one on their list of 100 greatest singers of all times. She also performed at the inauguration of Barack Obama. The former president said in describing Franklin, quote, "Nobody embodies more fully the connection between the African-American spiritual, the blues, R&B, rock and roll, the way that hardship and sorrow were transformed into something full of beauty and vitality and hope." And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News.